Thank you. Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Our next case is 822-0933, Anderson versus Anderson. You each will have 15 minutes for your principal argument, and appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. These sessions are being recorded, will be posted on our website. And so at the beginning of your argument, please state your name and who you are representing. And with that, is attorney for appellant ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
You may then.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Rhea Bornman Spears. I am appearing on behalf of appellant father Joshua Christian Anderson. We are calling to this court's attention that we, of course, believe the district court has abused its discretion in denying appellant's motion for a modification of custody based on endangerment. And we believe, obviously, that there should have been an evidentiary hearing. I'm focusing strongly on the cases and whatnot we cited and briefed in our documents that say that the appellate court strongly has, in the past, encouraged evidentiary hearings where emotional or physical endangerment is alleged. And we believe that we have given the court a plethora of facts to understand where my client is coming from in believing that his children are at risk of harm. And we believe that there were some major concessions made in the court's district court's memorandum that support our beliefs. Specifically, the court documented and acknowledged that a change in circumstances was proven and alleged, and that change that she identified referred to the emotional and physical well-being of the children, specifically the older girls who had had hospitalizations for mental health, suicidal ideations, and potentially attempts that would obviously move into the realm of endangering their physical safety as well as their emotional safety. We have relied very heavily on the case of Amara v. Amara, Court of Appeals 2018, and relied on the fact that that was a case that gave clear indication of what a district court could look for to know if endangerment was properly alleged based on the actions of the other parent. One of the key differences that I focused on a lot in using this case over the years is that it's not about whether alienation has occurred in the children or whether that's the actual explanation. It's about the actions of the other parent. So in this case, the actions of mother. And we have provided numerous examples for the court to show that she is not acknowledging that the court order requires her to make phone calls. She has continued to interfere and not cooperate for the process of the individual therapist communicating with and eventually coordinating for the reunification therapist. One thing I want to draw the court's attention to is that there is supposed to be reunification therapy happening in this process with an individual named Beth Pruitt. Now, that name would not normally matter in an appellate case, but I just want to point out that there is on page 17 of the addendum submitted by Mother, she identifies that, I mean, essentially she types a lie. She tells the court that that was a family therapist for father and children, and that they, let's see, she said that that individual ended therapy because they, quote, believed it was causing more harm than good at the time. However, this is a perfect example of our narrative, which is that mom is so not paying attention to her obligation to ensure that dad have contact through the reunification therapist that she didn't even remember that was the reunification therapist that she has outstanding releases to. And she mixed up the information and gave a false narrative that that individual was saying it wasn't good to see the children. That individual never got to see the children because mom won't cooperate with signing releases. So dad has been thwarted at every effort that he's made to see his children. He hasn't had meaningful contact in about 9 years. He hasn't had any contact in, I believe, about 6 years at this point.
Oh,
Ms. Bornman-Spears, I see
Yes.
the district court focused on the lack of any nexus between the change of circumstances and dad not seeing the kids, or that mom is causing, has caused the change of circumstances. So help me out there with that question.
Gladly, thank you for bringing that up. There is absolutely, we believe, an implied nexus, of course, and then of course we believe there's also the argued nexus. So the implied nexus is the fact that dad has not seen the kids. The only parent who has access to them is mom. And so for this many years gone by, including children who weren't even old enough at the time of divorce to have any of their own memories of negative interactions with dad, to still supposedly need therapy for trauma that they supposedly experienced all those many years ago, is just too far-fetched. And so we believe the fact that the older girl's mental health has continued to deteriorate, and that they've continued to have struggles in and requiring hospitalizations and whatnot, that that is an indicator of what's happening in the home now. And of course, the court acknowledged that as a change in circumstances, that their mental health is worsening. So for it to be worsening, and to the point the court acknowledged a change in circumstances, but dad to have had zero contact for all those years, that it's worsened. We believe is the nexus to say that that's mom either emotionally damaging the children with her narratives, or mom emotionally damaging the children by insisting that they reject their father and or keeping him away so that his absence affects them. We also
But the
believe that.
older kids, so this is where I'm trying to figure this all out. So the older kids have their own therapist, right? And the order just says it's up to the children's therapist. And so so how can we just assume, wait a minute, let's ignore what the therapists are saying? The district court made some kind of mistake there in order or find that the district court erred in not ordering. How do I get there?
Okay, so I'll help you. First of all, we don't know much about what the therapists are saying. That's all concealed. What we and mom alleges that they're saying that the kids are not ready for reunification therapy, but we don't have enough information and enough access to know. We just know she hasn't signed releases with the reunification therapist who could have talked to those individual therapists to find out if they're ready. So she's blocked that step from coming to fruition and the order working in that way. We also know that they've had hospitalizations. So we know that that shows that they are having changes in their present environment that is causing their emotional distress to increase and worsen. I also want to
Why
point out.
can't we equally assume? I mean, these are kind of late teens when, symptoms tend to become more significant. I mean, what
So,
under the structure of the prima facie case should we be looking at?
well, Your Honor, I'm going to point out that you use the word assume. So if we're going to make assumptions, we could go either way, and that would get me back to the point of needing an evidentiary hearing, because we're assuming that the problem is mom. And so if it's a prima facie situation and we believe that we can prove it, furthermore, I would direct you back to the science. So the science is the parental alienation theories and studies. And they say
But of course,
seven.
Ms. Knoopsen says that
Sure.
if they're in the domestic violence context, those studies don't apply.
And I appreciate Ms. Knoopsen making that argument. I think it's flawed, obviously. But I want to point out the fact that there are 17 strategies documented by alienation studies, and that we have science to say those actions by a parent cause emotional damage to the child. They say parental alienation causes the same emotional damage to a child as if they were sexually abused. And we know from being in this world of these cases that that's a very significant finding. And so mom has engaged in, as I argued in the transcript, I only made it halfway down the list. She's engaged in probably all of the 17 strategies, but at least we have the guardian ad litem report documenting that she's done at least 10 of them. And so the fact that we can show that there's evidence that's been found that she's taken those strategic actions against the well-being of the children. And then we also know of the effects that they've had to be hospitalized for suicidal ideations. And we know the research that says absence of a parent causes children's self-esteem to cut in half, causes potential suicidal ideations and issues such as these. We have enough, research and experience in that field to know that we have a nexus allegation there for sure. And obviously, we believe, based on the significant records and information that exists in this file, that we have enough to prove that that all comes back to mom's choices as a parent. And frankly, at this point, after all these years of a divorce later, why is mom still pushing this narrative and making these allegations to the children? They should have had a chance to move past all of this, especially if they've been in the therapy for the number of years and number of sessions she alleges they've been in. But instead, it seems it's a fresh topic, a constant reminder. And those, again, are strategies by mom. Your dad is unsafe. Your dad did this to you. And again, having those young children who weren't old enough to remember make allegations of things their father supposedly did to them, that is evidence of mom's efforts working and coming to fruition.
Can I ask a quick question? So is the appeal as to all the children? Because it seems to me we probably have at least one 18-year-old, we have a 17-year-old, and then we've got younger kids. So is it, at some point the kids have some agency?
I appreciate that question, Your Honor. Obviously, that's one of my clients' worst, fears with this case is that there are children aging out and he hasn't had a chance to access or be a part of their childhoods or, reconnect with them. And they will have a loyalty bind that continues past 18, where they'll have to choose between their father and their mother because that's clearly the environment that she's created for them. But yes, of course, we are appealing on behalf of all children because my client cares about and believes that she's doing it to all the children and believes it's damaging to all of the children. And yes, the boys are younger and reacting differently at this time, but who is to say that they won't be headed down the same path if she's allowed to continue with her actions? Is that it? It looks like I lost you for a second. Okay. I couldn't hear. I'm sorry. Are you mute?
Yeah, no, that's fine. You responded and
Okay.
go ahead. Yep, sorry.
All right. No problem. We also asked for or alleged that we believe it's an abuse of discretion that all the other motions were disregarded as well, just because we did ask for certain things that we believe obviously would help assist the court in seeing our concerns. And of course, we also rely heavily on the fact that there was a guardian ad litem on this case who had significant concerns. She had significant concerns about mom bouncing therapists. We tried to point out to the court that if we were granted our evidentiary hearing, we have at least one therapist who was willing to testify to the fact that when they said the child was ready to begin reunification therapy with dad, mom ended the parent or the child therapist relationship, trying to, of course, continue that prevention of the case progressing. Now that child is on to a different therapist, and we believe, that one has jumped onto mom's narrative of dad should have no contact. The guardian ad litem also had significant enough concerns about mother's mental health to recommend that she should have a psychological evaluation. The court declined that at that time, and the court declined it at our request. But we believed in asking for it that we would be able to provide the court with more information that would show why or support, I guess, our allegation of that nexus between mom and the suffering of, that the kids are experiencing. We also focused heavily, of course, because of the parallels between Amara in this case, on the phone calls and the fact that those are court ordered, because the fact that she has not made the phone calls and has transferred the responsibility to the children, saying they didn't want it. We also think that her record that she again included in her addendum, showing all of the phone call documentation, showing that there's allegations thrown in there, right? There's an allegation that one of the children heard dad strangling a dog in the phone
Ms.
call.
Foreman Spears, your
Yeah.
time is up. If you want to conclude, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Attorney for respondent, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
You may.
May it please the court, counsel, I am Dar Noobson. I represent the respondent in this matter, the mother, Laura Anderson. A brief recap of the history of this case, I think, is important for this court to have. That the parties separated, and in 2012, mother initiated an order for protection matter, which was litigated and ultimately granted on her behalf and on behalf of the children. In 2013, dissolution proceedings were initiated, and ultimately, the matter was settled by a stipulated agreement with both parties being represented by counsel. In that stipulated dissolution, the parties agreed that there would be no physical discipline and no emotional abuse perpetrated on the children, and that should that occur, that father's visits would revert to being supervised. Within weeks of that dissolution decree being signed by the judge, father's visits were restricted to supervised on that very basis. For nearly 6 months, father refused to see the children. And nearing that 6 month mark, brought a contempt action against mother, blaming mother for following the dissolution decree and reverting those visits to supervise. It was after that hearing, where father was represented by counsel, that father then began initiating contact with the children. And for a significant period of time, the children regularly attended those supervised visits. When father brought his motion in 2017, the court lifted the supervision restriction, but gave the children the autonomy to decline a visit if they chose. So the court gave that autonomy to those children. That motion for parenting time assistance brought in 2017 was ultimately resolved in June of 2019. During that period of time, by the time the parties had reached the evidentiary hearing in June of 2019, none of the children were electing to visit their father. But in that approximately 2 year period, father did not raise any concerns to the court about those decisions. There were no motions brought to the court. There were no allegations brought to the court. He was represented by counsel until about November of 2018. And then we had subsequent continuances as he attempted to obtain counsel for the evidentiary
Can
hearing.
I interrupt you just for a minute? I'm a little confused about the record. So we've got the, is it the 2019, that August 12, 2019 order is the one we're operating from, right? And then we're just dealing
Correct.
with denials after that. So are all the kids still under the treatment of of therapists? I mean, how is this working out with the younger kids? So I thought at least one of the younger kids was no longer in therapy.
Correct. The
Okay, go ahead.
The stipulated agreement that the parties entered into in June of 2019 indicated that mother would ensure that the children followed the recommendations of their therapists. And she continues to engage them in therapy. The child who is not currently in therapy, the youngest, and there is an attachment in mother's affidavit in my addendum that explains why the therapist ended therapy with that child. And I'm just going to correct perhaps what's a confusion in the appellant's argument. Father argued that mother didn't provide that information to him. And she showed through her affidavit and through that attachment that that decision was communicated from the child's therapist to father's therapist, who is a licensed family therapist, and father chose her to be the reunification therapist.
So with respect to the one that it's the youngest, right?
Correct.
Child who's not continuing to see a therapist. So there's no therapist saying that this child should not have I mean, I'm trying to figure out how this order works with respect to the youngest child.
What the youngest child's therapist stated is that at this time, the child has not expressed a desire to have contact with his father, and that it would be emotionally damaging to the child to force that contact at this time. Should the child express an interest, the therapist indicated that that would be an appropriate time to begin that process.
So how would that mechanism happen when the stipulated order says it's up to the children's therapist, but the kid isn't seeing a therapist? I guess that's my question, I guess, with respect to the one child.
Yeah, and as a practical matter, I think the way that would be handled is if the child expressed that interest, it would be mom's responsibility to re-engage him in a therapeutic process to allow for that to happen.
Okay.
When the parties entered into the agreement, the goal of that stipulated order was to remove the parties and allow the children to go through that process and to have the autonomy to deal with their trauma and to make their decisions on their own. There is a protective order in place, and the parties agreed to those restrictions in the stipulated order. And that was recommended by a therapist who had been evaluating the children based on their concerns about particularly father using what they had shared with their therapist in other ways. Unfortunately, in spite of the stipulated order and the prohibitions of having access to detailed information, and as the court found in the order that's being appealed, father violated those terms and obtained mental health information in violation of that order and submitted that as support of his motion. It seems to me that appellant has argued a lot about the nexus being established. In reality, mother really has actively shown, and what the record shows is that mother has followed the recommendations of the children's therapists. She didn't choose for the children to seek additional higher level of mental health care. That was recommended by the therapist, and mother followed through with that. If mother were not following through with addressing the children's mental health issues, we might have a different circumstance of endangerment, but that is not what has happened. Similarly, with the issue of education that was alleged in father's affidavit, that is a child, as mother pointed out in context, who has struggled academically for some time. And mother was taking appropriate steps to address those issues and had successfully done so. The court has properly considered the allegations in father's affidavit as true. Unfortunately, more than 13 times, father states in his affidavit that there never was any domestic abuse, that this is just a narrative mother has made up in spite of findings to the contrary, both in the order for protection hearing and in the family court file. The court should not be required to accept allegations as true where there are findings that are directly contrary to those allegations. Father's never appealed those allegations. Those findings exist. And the court properly applied mother's affidavit, reminding the court of that as context. The court can also consider mother's affidavit as explanation. And that's what the record shows. Father has alleged that mother has therapist shopped. And mother simply provided the history and what has happened to those therapeutic relations over the course of time. Simply, father's allegations, when placed in the context of the actual events that have occurred throughout the history of this case, show that mother has not been interfering with the relationship, that mother has not been doing the things that father has alleged in his affidavit. I would also like to point out that in order to get an evidentiary hearing, the movement must, or in this case, the appellant, must establish all four prongs. And as the lower court correctly identified, two of those prongs were not even addressed in the appellant's motion. The appellant did not address why it is in the best interest of the children, but instead argues that the court should infer that. Well, that's effectively shifting the burden of establishing the prima facie case onto the court. And that is not the court's role. Nor did appellant address the harm benefits analysis. And for that, I want to point to the specific remedies that are requested by the appellant. It was for an immediate removal of the children from mother's custody. It was for a total restriction of all contact between the children and their mother. Not only was mom the primary caregiver prior to the separation, by father's agreement on custody and parenting time, she has remained the primary caregiver throughout these children's lives. But the remedy that's being asked for by the appellant is that that relationship be completely ended. Furthermore, the parties do not reside in the same county. Therefore, the changes for the children would involve ending a relationship with their mental health providers, their medical providers, their school system, their friends, their social circles, to be immediately placed with their father and cut off from everything they know. The appellant doesn't even address that in the motion for an evidentiary hearing. The court was well within its discretion in determining that the appellant failed to establish a prima facie showing, in that he failed to establish that there was endangerment, failed to establish that a change of custody was in the best interests of the children, and failed to establish a prima facie case that the harm of that change is going to be outweighed by the benefit. With regards to the issue of phone call, and briefly to address appellant's references to mother not being willing to forward gifts or letters, mother's decision with regards to the gifts and letters and messages from father was appropriate. Those things were to be handled and should have been handled through the therapeutic process. Father should and could have been discussing with his reunification therapist his desire to send letters and cards and gifts. Those could have been handled then in a therapeutic setting. Father took no steps to do so. You'll also find in my addendum where mother explains that she was asked to not continue to force the children to gather around the table for the speakerphone phone calls. because it was emotionally damaging for the children. So mother tried to come up with the best possible solution, which was to provide a phone with father's number, giving the children free access to use it as they please. Father could have also been proactive in addressing that issue through his reunification therapist and asking her to reach out to the children's therapists with regards to what might be a way to have communications. Father did none of that. So, you know, he bears responsibility here, but has not taken any responsibility. He hasn't taken responsibility for his contribution to the relationship. Parental alienation theorists have consistently stated that there may be legitimate and justifiable reasons that children are uncomfortable or unwilling to engage with one of their parents. Appellant would like you to just disregard that. And I think attempts to do that in an affidavit that on more than 13 times claims the history of domestic abuse in this case was simply made up.
Thank you. I see that your time is up. Ms. Foreman Spears, any rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. First off, I want to cite a fact from alienation research, which is that they've found that children who are actually abused do not reject the parent. It's contrary to our biological nature and whatnot. And the usual reaction is actually,
Where in the record are you citing to? Because I want to make sure we're staying within the record that was before the district court.
No problem, Your Honor. Actually, both parties submitted to the district court memos and treatises on alienation. And so I believe that it would either be Gardner or Baker. One of those treatises will have this because this is a standard understanding based on their studies of foster care children. And so that's something I just want to point out to the court to contradict the fact that Ms. Knoopsen is saying that there is some legitimacy to the fact that the children have not had any contact with father. I also want to remind the court that within the record, we documented for the district court the fact that mother is still actively reaching out, trying to push the narrative of father being a monster, and did so with a stranger that dad adopted a dog from. She found out he adopted a dog and contacted the individual that adopted the dog to him and actively trashed him, essentially, to that person, telling that individual she didn't know what a monster and abuser he was. We brought that up to the district court as well. We believe that if she would go that far with a stranger, that of course she's actively doing it with the children. We also want to tell the court that counsel alleged that father made a number of agreements. Yes, father made repeated agreements and believed in the ongoing history of this case, that if he actively acted as a doormat to mother, that he would get some scraps and see his kids. And yes, we do know that there, from practicing in this area, that there are many individuals who will continue to insist that even though a court made findings of abuse, it doesn't necessarily mean it actually happened. Unfortunately, our system is only as strong as believing, you know, choosing between one party who's credible or who's not. Father's point is that mother never actually provided actual evidence, no witness, no pictures, no nothing to show that the domestic abuse that she alleged was true. But the court believed her testimony over his. He now, you know, obviously we've reconciled that as attorney and client, explaining to him that he went through that process because he was confused and did not realize that you know, how huge that was, that he went through that process and those findings happened. And I also want to point out that counsel continues to say dad could reach out to the reunification therapist for this. Dad could reach out for that. The reunification therapist has a wall. She cannot contact the individual therapists of the children because mom won't sign the releases. So she is only as good as if she had those releases by mom. And as I pointed out in the beginning of this argument, by page 17 of mom's addendum, she clearly shows she doesn't even realize the name Beth Pruitt is the individual she's supposed to be signing those releases for because of the false narrative she wrote about that therapist. And also, mom tells us supposedly she was asked to not gather the children for calls and that it was supposedly damaging to the children. What could be so damaging about those calls? There's millions of distant or tons of distance between the father and child. They're phone calls. And again, that's a one-sided piece of information. No therapeutic documentation to back up her assertion that that's the case. And we also know that the guardian ad litem documented that was concerning, that she was reporting things on behalf of the therapist and that she was doing the therapist shopping. So that's not just father's allegation. I also want to point out that the guardian ad litem objected to the order that the judge made, the protective order. She thought it went too far and even prevented the guardian from accessing information. And the judge ordered it over her objection. And I do not believe that my client agreed to that protective order. And yes, he did obtain information regarding his children because mom was required to have shared that with him and asked for his input for the treatment, and she didn't. And so the therapist, the providers contacted father in their process, and that's how he was alerted to the fact that that happened. So that's something he included, and the court also did not strike it. And they thought it might be useful for this court.
Spears, you're out of time. Up if you want to make a conclusory statement.
My conclusory statement is that we have thrown enough stuff out here for both you and the district court to back up the fact that we need an evidentiary hearing. When there's the allegations we've made and the concerns that we've raised, the court has said to err on the side of having an evidentiary hearing, and that's what we're asking for. So, thank you.
Thank you very much. The case is submitted.